Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with Dr. Carmen Boulter. She's director and producer of the documentary series The Pyramid Code. We talk with her about her book, Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one on the Huffington Post, Agenda 21. Georgia governor names Obama conspiracy theorist state senator to task force. Georgia's Republican governor isn't saying why he gave a part-time seat on a state task force to the state senator who organized a four-hour briefing that told Republican lawmakers President Barack Obama and the United Nations are engaging mind control techniques to force a land use agenda. Governor Nathan Deal, a Republican, last week named Senate Majority Leader Chip Rogers to a seat on the governor's Digital Learning Task Force, formed earlier this year to study ways the state can use digital technology in schools, including digital textbooks. The governor, Deal, made the appointment before a video surfaced of the meeting Rogers organized last month on Agenda 21, the United Nations Sustainability Program. Senator Rogers has been nationally recognized for his leading efforts in digital learning. I appreciate his willingness to serve as we strive to make Georgia the premier state for incorporating new technology into the learning process, Deal said in a Senate statement about the Rogers appointment. The task force position is unpaid. Deal's spokesperson did not return messages seeking comment about Rogers' appointment and asking whether the governor agrees with the Agenda 21 lecture, which included a birther activist telling Republican senators that Obama and the UN are using mind control to force through the program. Rogers holds the task force seat in addition to a Senate seat. Rogers couldn't be reached for comment. Rogers dropped his bid to seek a third two-term as Senate Majority Leader during a Republican caucus meeting on Thursday evening, citing a desire to spend more time with his family. But Better Georgia, the progressive group that taped the Agenda 21 meeting, claimed credit for forcing Rogers out of the majority leader's race. Listeners, if you notice here, this Huffington Post article is not saying what the Agenda 21 is about. This is a propaganda piece at best. The article continues, Brian Long, the executive director of Better Georgia, told Huffington Post that while the Agenda 21 meeting was held in October, the group waited to distribute the video in order to analyze the claims and to affect the majority leader race. Long said the group also didn't want to release the tape in the midst of election coverage. Rogers had previously pushed Agenda 21 bans in the state Senate, including an amendment to a land use bill in 2011 that failed by two votes. Agenda 21 was adopted by the United Nations during a 1992 climate change summit in Brazil to promote sustainability. Well, I might add that the UN Agenda 21 was drafted in the 1970s. Here goes more propaganda in this Huffington Post story. Agenda 21 does not have the force of law in the United States, but has become a favorite target of Tea Party activists in recent years. That statement might be true, but it's taken out of context. Several states have passed laws to ban or oppose the UN agenda. During the Senate GOP caucus briefing, a birther activist claimed that Agenda 21 would ban rural development, livestock grazing, paved roads, floor and wall tiles, modern hunting, single-family homes, private property, power line construction, sewers, golf courses, scuba diving, and synthetic drugs. The presentation also compared Obama's rural agenda with genocide programs by leaders in China and Russia. I say this is a propaganda piece at best because they fail to tell you what Agenda 21 really is. They failed to show you another side of it by authors such as Rosa Corey, who wrote the book Behind the Green Mask, and that, remember, she's a forensic commercial real estate appraiser and a Democrat. It doesn't fit nicely into a box where you can divide and conquer like the angle this story is coming from. Here's another story by Elaine Watson. Goldfish crackers targeted in natural lawsuit over genetically engineered soy as Proposition supporters launch GMO Inside initiative. While Proposition 37 didn't pass, the failure to disclose the presence of GMOs in foods that are marketed as natural is still generating a steady stream of civil litigation, with Goldfish crackers, the latest brand to be targeted, in a class action lawsuit over genetically engineered ingredients. In a complaint filed in a U.S. district court in Colorado last week, plaintiff Sonia Balarczyk alleged that Pepperidge Farm, owned by Campbell Soup, had mistakenly or misleadingly represented that its cheddar goldfish crackers are, quote, natural, when in fact they are not, because they contain genetically modified organisms in the form of soy and or soy derivatives. Balarczyk, who is represented by law firm Howard W. Rubenstein, alleges that, quote, genetically modified soy products contains genes and or DNA that would not normally be in them and thus are not natural. Seeking to represent a nationwide class of consumers who purchased the crackers since November 2008, Balarczyk alleges violation of Colorado's Consumer Protection Act, breach of express warranty and negligent misrepresentation, and seeks damages in a jury trial. A spokesperson for Pepperidge Farm told Food Navigator-USA, quote, "We don't comment on specifics on pending litigation, but we're confident in the accuracy of our labels and stand behind our products." The attorney says, "I would still expect enterprising plaintiff lawyers to bring lawsuits for all natural claims made with GMO ingredients." An attorney in the Denver office of a law firm, Greenberg Traurig, said the action proved that food companies remained vulnerable to lawsuits over the use of GMOs, regardless of the defeat of California GMO Labeling Initiative Proposition 37. He added, quote, "I'm sure the close margin will only encourage proponents to renew efforts the next go-round, perhaps with some changes to the private right of action provisions, which seem to be the real sticking point for many opponents." Well, this is really interesting. The food that the public is buying off the shelves in stores is mislabeled. The FDA is involved. The USDA is involved. Corporations are involved. Monsanto, of course, is involved. Local, state, federal government is involved in covering it up. It's up to the people to bring class action lawsuits against this. Because look at this story. Here's a story. Court rules GMOs okay on wildlife refuges. This is on beyondpesticides.org. A lawsuit challenging the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, that's FWS, practice of permitting genetically engineered crops on wildlife refuges was dismissed by U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. The suit filed by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, PEER, the Center for Food Safety, and Beyond Pesticides, charged that FWS unlawfully entered into cooperative farming agreements and approved planting of genetically engineered crops in 54 national wildlife refuges in various states without environmental review required by the National Environmental Policy Act and in violation of FWS policy. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg in Washington, D.C., rejected the plaintiff's arguments, ruling that the agency's actions were not arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion or otherwise not in accordance with the law. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees 150 million acres of refuges, allowed farmers to plant GE corn and soybean on a limited basis in 8 Midwestern states. The plaintiffs, the Center for Food Safety, Beyond Pesticides, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, and the Cornucopia Institute claimed the decision violated environmental law. Farming has long been used on national wildlife refuges for multiple purposes, like habitat restoration, which involves destroying invasive species to make room for native plants. However, in recent years, refuge farming has been converted to GE crops because the agency claims genetically engineered seed is the only seed farmers can obtain today. In my opinion, that's not a good reason. These GE crops are mostly engineered for a single purpose, to be resistant to herbicides, mainly Monsanto's ubiquitous Roundup. Because the crops are tolerant to herbicides, their plantings lead to more frequent applications and increased amount of toxic herbicides. This over-reliance on herbicides used in GE cropping systems has fostered an epidemic of herbicide-resistant superweeds in the past decade, as weeds have mutated. The article continues. This is the time of year, usually, you'll hear about a million fish washing ashore, birds falling out of the sky. Just take one look at the sky. especially here in New York. They're saturating the sky with aerosol. God only knows what these particulates are. There's no oversight. No one's saying anything. No one's standing up. A ragtag group of people who are pointing this out. Here's the story. Mysterious deaths of thousands of migrating birds lost at sea. Fishermen have reported seeing hundreds of seemingly exhausted and disoriented garden birds dropping from the sky into the waters off England's south coast. One professional boat skipper told the conservation charity, while fishing about 10 miles south of Portsmouth, "We witnessed thousands of garden birds, disoriented, land on the sea, and most of them are drowning. The species included goldcrests, robins, thrushes, and blackbirds. The sky was thick with garden birds. I estimate I saw 500 birds die, and that was just in our 300-yard sphere. On the way home, we just saw dead songbirds in the water. It was a harrowing sight." Martin Harper, with the RSVP's conservation director, said, "The scale of these reports are truly shocking, and it has the potential to adversely affect the status of species, which may be declining for other reasons." Unfortunately, you probably will not get a conservation director or anyone in those circles to point at the saturation of aerosols in the sky, the subsequent microwave beaming of those conductive particles in the sky. Do you think that might have an effect on a migrating bird's orientation? Here's another story. And to me, this really connects to Agenda 21. Man tasered by police calls it brutal. This is in Pinellas Park, Florida. Daniel Jensen wasn't running from the law. He was trying to protect his home from burning up, yet Pinellas Park police tasered him in the process. Jensen and his attorney say it's an excessive use of force. Jensen was still shaken and visibly emotional as he retold what happened last Thursday evening. He said being tasered by police has not only impacted him, but it also impacted his children, who saw it all happen. He described the Pinellas Park police officers' actions as brutal. He said they showed no compassion. The 42-year-old father of two recalls his wife waking him around 6 in the evening, saying there's a big fire at his neighbor's house. "I could feel it and hear it," he explained. He ran outside and grabbed a fire extinguisher. He sprayed it until it was empty. "I was calling for my daughter and getting no response. I came out, grabbed the hose, and sprayed her room until I heard she was out. I was also taught to help when you can. Help is what I tried to do," he said. He continued to recount the events. He said he then took the garden hose and started watering down his fence and the back corner of his rooftop, trying to prevent the fire from spreading to his property. But with each attempt, Daniel said Pinellas Park police kept pulling him back, even though firefighters were not in sight. "They kept telling me, 'Let it go. That's what insurance is for.' 'Well, that's not acceptable to me,' said Jensen." When Jensen saw the fire jump onto his back roof, he again grabbed the hose. That's when he said, unknown to him, the police officer pulled out a taser and fired it at his back. "As I went to grab the hose, I hear an officer on this side. There was a boat here. He was just behind it. He said, 'Hit him, take him down, tase him.' Jensen says, 'I didn't know they were talking to me or about me. I was concerned about putting water on the fire, and the next thing you know, I'm being tased.'" You hear these stories all the time, but I think this stands out a little more because the quote here by Jensen saying, "They kept telling me, 'Let it go. That's what insurance is for.'" And he didn't stop putting water on the fire on his property. And so they tasered him. Here's another story from DNA Info. It's titled, "Now That's Compassion for You." The city's Department of Buildings has slapped violations on homeowners of condemned homes in Breezy Point that were destroyed during Hurricane Sandy. DNAinfo.com New York has learned dozens of already shell-shocked homeowners trying to deal with the aftermath of the storm found tickets nailed to their crushed homes this week. One violation cited, quote, "failure to maintain the building," and the ticket's wording threatened, quote, "criminal prosecution if the problem was not," quote, "immediately corrected." "It was shocking," one homeowner said after finding the summons taped to a mangled storm door Friday. "Here I am dealing with a house that's off its foundation. It's condemned. I finally found a contractor with a bulldozer to push it to the curb so that it could be taken away by FEMA," said the owner, who requested anonymity. "And just as I'm about to watch my house be carted away on the back of a trailer by FEMA, The contractor sees a white piece of paper tacked to it. A spokesman for the building's department told DNAinfo.com that the notices were simply a formality of the process, not intended as a notice of civil action. Quote, these violations were issued to document the damage that occurred and don't carry any monetary penalties for the property owner. Still, that offered little consolation for the homeowners left with nothing after their homes were torn down, but the words on that piece of paper. I didn't know what it was, and then I stood in the street watching my house being taken away, and I'm reading this paper, and it's a summons for a building violation, said the homeowner. What are they smoking down there? He wondered about the building's workers. In past shows, the discussion of men and archetypes has been examined, and in a recent interview with Dr. Paul Dobransky, we talked with him about his book, King, Warrior, Magician, and Lover in the Opposite Sex, How to Instantly Recognize Your One True Life Partner. Well, after that show, a couple listeners sent a message requesting to have discussions about the feminine archetypes. It's fortunate that Dr. Carmen Bolter's book, Angels and Archetypes, An Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness, has just come back into print. This 1997 publication examines an original system and framework for understanding the mythology of the 22 goddesses and their relevance to modern women. For the past 5,000 years, the culture has supported the masculine archetype. Many people argue things aren't exactly going in the right direction. Greed is rampant, conspicuous theft, deliberate poisoning in plain sight of the air, food, and water, Orwellian nightmares of voting for the labeling of poisoned food. We talk with Dr. Carmen Bolter about the importance of understanding the feminine archetype that exists in psychological structures not only within women, but also within men. Dr. Bolter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you on, and your book is just an amazing book. I'm glad it's back in print. The book is titled Angels and Archetypes, An Evolutionary Map of the Feminine Consciousness. But before we begin to look into the content of the book, could you define archetype for listeners?
Well, the word archetype is actually a Latin word, and it comes all the way from Plato's time. And it means first molded, the beginning or the origin. So a pattern, a model, or a type. And in the psychological sense, Carl Jung, who was a student of Freud's, started using the term as an aspect of our own personal development or lack of development. And so when we're not aware of ourselves, what Jung would say is that we're relegating pieces of ourselves to the shadow. Something that's in our shadow, that's unconscious, will often run us. And so it will turn into some kind of a pattern that's actually self-sabotaging or negative. And so this is psychological work, but it's also really important to understand that an archetype exists whether we're aware of it or not. And so that's why Carl Jung thought it was so important to pull things out of the subconscious, out of the unconscious, and bring them onto the table so we can become more conscious.
In your book, you list the 22 angels that connect in mythology to these particular archetypes. Why did you choose 22?
The major arcana in the Tarot talks about 22 types. What's true is a lot of the sacred knowledge that came from ancient cultures was sublimated during the Inquisition, and you know, people were tortured and killed and burned at the stake for believing in herbology, and so a lot of the information got turned into things like numerology, astrology, tarot. And so it was a form that ancient knowledge could come forward. And so I used all three of those to make the pattern in the book.
There are archetypes for men, of course, and we've discussed some of that on the show in the past. But is it important for women to know about their own archetypes?
Yes, men and women are very different. Male archetypes are things like the warrior, the hero, the king, the lover, and feminine archetypes are like the great mother, the the wise woman, the sage, and they each are relegated into different characteristics. And so we're different. We're different. But as Jung would say, there's the feminine counterpart in a man, which is the anima, and then there's a masculine counterpart in a woman, which is the animus. Now, all of this sounds very technical and complicated, but it's basic psychological work. And we're not invited to do much of that in our culture, but I think it's the most important thing we can do in terms of self-reflection to get to know ourselves and to live a more fulfilled life.
In your work, especially with the documentary series, The Pyramid Code, and you were on before talking about that with the listeners, but you've seen deliberate action to remove that level of education or information about ourselves throughout history. It seems that the powers that be don't want that level of reflection within their populace.
Well, that's a very strong point. It seems that the agenda of the patriarchy that we've been living in for at least 5,000 years has been to erase evidence of everything other than itself. So massive book burnings in the Mayan culture, and hiding everything in the Vatican Library under lock and key so nobody can get in there, the burning of the Library of Alexandria. And I think what's fundamental to it all is the idea of people giving their power away. And the idea of, in the patriarchy, power over someone else seems to be the driving force. But when we do our own psychological work, it's empowering. And so in matriarchal cultures, which isn't the opposite of patriarchy, it meant that there was a balance between the masculine and the feminine. The idea of personal empowerment was the most important thing. And the idea of seeking consciousness and becoming more aware was the highest value. And so in our culture, it's all about, you know, if you don't get caught, it's not wrong. It's about profit. It's about not caring about other people, killing people who are in your way. And that's just a completely different fabric of culture than what's being described in Angels and Archetypes.
That area I'd like to go back into a little bit later, but before we go into that, I wanted to just get your opinion of something that Robert Bly mentioned in one of his books about young men who didn't grow up with a father or a significant mature male role model. And in that absence, psychologically, a hole is formed in that area where, and it's replaced by demons. And older, mature men then become negative or demonic to that young man. He even goes further to say that you can't even kill this demon. The demon, psychologically, has to be educated. I wonder if there's something similar to young women who don't have a healthy rite of passage or healthy feminine, mature role model or mother in their life.
Absolutely. I mean, that was well stated. And that's what a person would present with if they came in to a psychologist and they were uncomfortable and they understood that they had certain blocks and places that they didn't understand. Because what happens is our behavior starts to manifest in ways that gets us in trouble, that isn't pleasant, our relationships break down. But I think things are improving and feminine consciousness is coming to the forefront, and I think that's what part of this 2012 transition is, as we go through the galactic alignment, that the feminine is being reborn and joining with Gaia, the planet, and living in harmony with her instead of against her is becoming more into the forefront in the collective. Unconscious, perhaps, but it is becoming more conscious. But we really haven't had positive images of femininity. I mean, women are supposed to be skinny as rakes and attractive to men and obedient and all of that. And so most of the modeling that we have in our culture is masculine-oriented. And so even if there's a good mother, sometimes it's the too-good mother who's, you know, spoils the child in a way that she doesn't stand on her own two feet, and the mother is all complex with the daughter. So there's many, many complications here with our mothers not having proper role models. Our grandmothers not having proper role models, and so things just keep getting passed down. Most people are quite lost, to tell you the truth, and they're not connected to personal development, which I think is a real shame, because I think that's the reason that we're here.
Dr. Bolter, that was very profound, and that's a major statement to say that most people are lost on that particular level in searching for their own particular archetype in a way that becomes fulfilling, you know, psychologically and out in the physical world as well. I wonder if in your work you've been able to recognize particular archetypes that manifest in modern women when you meet individuals.
Well, I used to work with eating disordered women, and that's relegated to the Persephone daughter. And she gets lost in the underworld, and nobody can find her. You know, Demeter comes to her rescue, and she's in the underworld with her uncle, who is raping and molesting her. And she's not supposed to eat anything when she's down there, and if she ends up eating a pomegranate seed and being relegated into the underworld, well, this is a description of the deep unconscious. And in our culture, we're mostly distracted by, you know, TV and all the, you know, stars and movies and all that sort of thing that gets us away from understanding ourselves. But what we have is a real problem with anorexia and bulimia and eating disorders and even obesity, which is part of that. And it's this whole distortion. So the Persephone daughter is the bulimic daughter. And what she's doing is that she's running a lot of the emotional energy from the family dynamic through her belly, if you will. And then she's, what they say, kneeling at the porcelain altar and throwing it all up. And so there's an awful lot of women who have distorted body image. And we're taught that. Like when we look at the TV, everybody's like super skinny. And then the obesity rates are going up and up. And so, you know, women can get really caught in this where their whole life is about their weight. And, so you see, that's just one example of an archetype. Now, if we're only run by one archetype, that becomes a complex. And that becomes a deep psychological condition that can actually kill women. There's women who die from eating disorders, from anorexia and from bulimia. And so, this isn't something that, this is very serious. It's not something to skip over. But there's an interesting statistic that men whose careers involve how they look, male models, ballet dancers, dancers in general, they have bulimia and anorexia at the same rate that all women do.
Oh, what does that tell us?
It tells us that if culture is pushing us to look a certain way and to perceive ourselves as inadequate, not good enough and not pretty enough, and all the advertising media is saying you need to pluck, preen, change color your hair, change this, change that, wear makeup, compensate for yourself. It's telling us that the messages that we receive, and we're talking thousands of them, every magazine, every everything, every ad that we look at on TV, anywhere, a billboard, is all saying you're not good enough.
You mentioned that a single archetype is a complex, but do you see a blend also, a blend of archetypes in individuals?
Sure, but everybody's individual. Now, my vision is that you'd stand in the center of the circle and there'd be a ribbon going to each of the 22 archetypes, and the person standing in the middle can hold each of them, hold each ribbon. So if we drop one ribbon, then that goes into the shadow. So perhaps Baba Yaga, who I call the Queen of the Bad Hair Day, I don't want to deal with any of that. I need to be pretty. I need to be out in the world. Well, then she'll come and take us and, you know, have us be in bed and feeling terrible for a few days a month. And so that's, if we don't acknowledge and understand certain aspects of ourselves, it comes and has a consequence. Alternatively, if someone's standing in the circle and they're only holding one ribbon, as I mentioned before, like the Persephone daughter, then she's stuck too, because her behavior is largely unconscious and she hasn't understood the other aspects of herself.
Well, this leads to the idea of individuation, which is another Jungian term and that you reference. And can you describe the importance of individuation in terms of self-reflection, becoming, you know, integrated in society?
Sure. We live in a particularly individualistic kind of culture. And so individuation is when a child puts their back to the family and steps out into the world on their own, and typically this happens when we're 18 years old. And so things are changing, though, with the economy, because a lot of kids are going back home. I call it the revolving doors. They leave, and then they go back home to their parents, and then they leave again. But the idea of individuation is that we are saying, I am not my mother, I am not my father, I am myself, and I'm taking my developing self into the world to explore, to reflect, to see who I am. And so we also see collectivist cultures, like in China and even Egypt. So there's extroverted and introverted, individuated and collectivist cultures. And so this is a different style of modeling. Individuation is when we become ourselves. And I think we need to be encouraged to become ourselves. And so, and that typically happens in young adults.
And that's recognizing that you're an individual, but you're also part of society at the same time.
That's correct. However, when you look at, like, I've lived in six countries and been to 53 countries and really looked at the different styles, a different way that a culture focuses on the family, for example. And so individuation is going to be mean different things in different cultural groupings, that's for certain. But in North American culture, we're expected to leave home and to, you know, forge out there for ourselves. But in other cultures, kids stay around, the grandparents live in the family home, and all the generations are all there together, and the little babies are bounced from knee to knee, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In the empowering process for women, on this show we've focused in on the archetypes for men, and now we're just looking at the sacred feminine and the psychological constructs around the archetypes. In the empowering process for women, are women more empowered not by being more masculine, but becoming more aware of their depth and dimension of their feminine source?
Yeah, but in matriarchal cultures, where I think we had a greater balance, the idea was to balance between the masculine and the feminine and understand them both. And so it's not, like, ideas of femininity, as I said before, are completely distorted on TV. It kind of means frail, maybe stupid, a little bit stupid, and obedient to the man and having no opinions and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you see the aggressive kind of feminine, and you wonder if, you know, it's actually a man dressed up as a woman kind of thing. So I think that, and I've been calling, you know, the images that we've been seeing in movies gender benders, because there's all kinds of distortions in terms of how we're showing, the masculine and the feminine and gay and all of that. So I think, you know, when you think about what is really being shown to us through, you know, TV programs and the media, it's actually quite a departure from full-scale consciousness. So I think this is difficult for people to understand. But I will say that, you know, my book is getting far more attention now than it was when I wrote it a long time ago. It seems that it was really ahead of its time, and people didn't even know how to relate to these ideas. More people are getting some, you know, decent counseling to understand the distress in their lives and, you know, what psychologically is holding them back.
You mentioned that some very interesting information about pedophiles and those who molest children, and they're stealing something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I actually learned this when I was doing my research for my master's, and I was looking at brain functioning and the ability to visualize and what made people good hypnotic subjects and that sort of thing. And the left brain is the domain of the masculine, and the right brain is the domain of the feminine. And so what our culture endorses and feeds is the left brain. So that's reading, writing, arithmetic. If you can't see it, it's not there. And the right brain is all about symbolism and mystery and dreams and creativity and things that you can't see, that you're pulling out of nothing, if you will. And so we don't respect that, typically. And so there have been studies done on the brains of child molesters and pedophiles, and they are completely left brain dominant with no activity in the right brain. Now, the Egyptians actually had these crowns that would have like a serpentine going across the corpus callosum, and creative thinking is the interaction between the two sides of the brain.
Wow.
So the nature seeks a balance. It insists on a balance. And so if somebody is completely out of balance in terms of their brain functioning, they will literally go and steal the feminine energy from a little girl. So when a man, you know, rapes and molests, and he's completely dysfunctional in his own brain patterning, nature seeks that balance, and he'll go steal it. these are metaphors. Like, we have a very distorted sick society. I mean, the fact that anybody's killing anybody anymore and that they're still making guns and making war and, you know, and hurting people and polluting, I mean, that just doesn't make sense. And we've come to accept it. I mean, it's like we're blind walking around and, you know, we're being fed on media propaganda. And so there's very few people that are working with consciousness compared to the masses. And I think that we're in trouble. In fact, we don't even have this vocabulary. This conversation isn't one that many are interested in, really.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Carmen Bolter about her book, Angels and Archetypes, An Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness. The other aspect is the way soldiers are trained, male soldiers are trained, in that the feminine is killed inside them. In fact, the anima, I guess, is the female inside of the male, is it's made sure that that is killed so that they then can go out and kill as well. But in a broader sense, I was just thinking about what's in our world right now, the way nature is being destroyed. How can somebody, consciously do this? Is it that also that the feminine is part of its dead inside of them, inside of the male?
Yes, I think that's quite astute of you to say that. And what it is dissociation. So things are compartmentalized. And even with computer games and PlayStations and all of that, they train people how to drop bombs. This programming starts when we're little children. And they've even done studies with pink blankets and blue blankets and switching them and having the boys in the pink blankets and seeing how people will hold the pink blanket, the girl, for longer, put them up on their shoulder so that they can look around and they get a different perspective. There's completely different behavior the way right from the day somebody's born. But then when you start looking at toys and Disney films, the boys are the hero, the action hero, the one who kills and the one who has the gun, and the girls are there with their dolls, and the programming is just incredible. But it's far more devious than just the gender roles. And then a lot of these computer games are violent. There's a new diagnostic disorder in the DSM-4, which is the all diseases possible, and it's nature deprivation. So imagine these little boys who are, turnkey kids, and both the parents are out working, and then they're dropping bombs on people, and they're winning by killing more. Well, then that's the exact mechanism when they're operating a drone, or they're, dropping bombs when they're in their fighter jets, is that they just get trained to be completely desensitized, and they don't know what they've just, they don't go walk on the ground and see who they've killed. And so this programming starts when they're infants.
Dr. Bolter, you suggested that I check out View Again, Episode 4 of The Pyramid Code, and I did. Jeez, it just made me think that I have to watch the whole thing again. It leads me to ask you and to tell listeners what a matriarchal system looks like and what it did look like at one time.
So let's start at the beginning here. When I was running the Women's Therapy and Research Center, one of our local colleges had a research assistance program, and they wanted to send me 2 full-time research assistants for 9 months, and I could choose any topic that I sent them to look for things. And so I thought, okay, what do I really want to know? And my question was, what happened between matriarchal cultures that gave way to patriarchy? Like, how did that transition happen? Because I knew that from the research I'd been doing my whole life, that the older cultures were matriarchal, but we're still looking at them through patriarchal lenses. And, you know, in the 1900s, Darwin, Freud, all of them, and even the beginning of archaeology was the old boys club, and, you know, talking about penis envy, which to me is procreation envy distorted. And so the beginning of the research was looking at matriarchal cultures. And so these researchers would find articles that were in journals, but none of the institutions had the journals. So finally I ended up in Montreal at Concordia University at the Simone de Beauvoir Institute Library, and all of these feminist journals were there. And I was able to find quite a bit of very, very interesting information about how ancient sites looked like before, and that lined up with a lot of my intuition that really looked at the differences between matriarchal and patriarchal cultures. So, as I said, the patriarchy's agenda is to erase evidence about anything other than itself. So a lot of these fragments were kept because of something like bread making or wine making that involved periodicity and fermentation and those sorts of things. And so in a matriarchal culture, the idea was to leave more for the children, to respect the wisdom of the elders, and to see how living in harmony with the earth in nature was the most important thing. Well, the beginning of dynastic Egypt was the beginning of the Mayan calendar, 3113 BC, which is the patriarchal period. And so anything before that was matriarchal in Egypt. And so what you see over and over and over again in the frescoes, which is demonstrated in episode 4, which is called The Empowered Human, is balance, balance, balance. And I'm going through all the symbols in there, the masculine and the feminine. And if you go to the temple, there's the winged disc above your head. There's no temple in Egypt that doesn't have that. And the idea is to surrender the lower self, which is the ego, everyday kind of person, to the higher self, which is the soul energy, in balance. The masculine and the feminine within each person is in balance before you step into the temple to do the holy work, which is the high work, the work on yourself. And so this idea is matriarchal in nature. So in patriarchy, they just lop off the feminine. We don't need her. And in fact, in Greek mythology, Aphrodite is born out of Zeus's head, Athena. So, you know, they just smack him on the head, and here comes the baby. And what they're saying is, now that we understand procreation, we don't need the women. We don't even need a womb anymore. And that, you know, kind of set the template. And then the Bible, you know, which came before it, but, you know, just distorting everything about the feminine. Prior to that, we had a whole different sense of living on the earth in harmony. And the ancient Egyptians certainly demonstrate that beautifully.
That's some of the material that Dr. Ross Hamilton writes about in his book, Star Mounds and a Tradition of Giants. He also mentions that. But that's more about here in the U.S. 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. However, I guess what I'm understanding here, and also based on watching the episode 4 of the Pyramid Code again, I noticed that in matriarchal societies, the balance has to occur psychologically, and then when that occurs, you then begin to reach a higher consciousness. You even mentioned that we used to have 360 senses. The matriarchal society allowed for a higher consciousness to evolve.
You bet. You bet. And there's something about the way the world works now that really is dumbing us down in every possible way, with unhealthy food and everything's mechanized, and school is about training people to be good little workers, factory workers, and it's erasing creativity. And yes, so Hakim is an indigenous wisdom keeper who learned through the oral tradition in Egypt. He's passed away now. And he was very adamant about the idea of 360 senses. And I've been doing a lot of research on what would that look like, how could we measure it. And what I did for the Pyramid Code is I took a priestess with her chakras and stood her inside a sphere. And the sphere, it's like a globe that has the cross-quarter points and the longitude and latitude lines, and I imagine that each cross point could be where another sense would happen. So I actually brought people into the Great Pyramid and did a study before, inside, and after, measuring the alignment of their chakras and the size of their energy field through electrophotonic imaging. And my speculation here was that I've been going to Egypt since 1977, spending a lot of time inside the Great Pyramid, and I'm on my way for the 28th time. And it's been my experience going inside the body of the Sphinx and being inside the Great Pyramid was changing me in some way, and I was becoming increasingly psychic. And I know that intuition and telepathy are like a muscle. You have to use them, and you have to listen. And a lot of people get messages, but they don't listen to them. You know, take your umbrella, it's going to rain. No, they'll forecast that it's not going to rain. All kinds of things we do to trick ourselves. And so I was trying to figure out what actually connects us more and what does it mean to be psychic. And that led me into a literature review about synesthesia, which is cross-sensory perception. And little babies have it, and lots of people can do it, but it's rare because most of us are so distracted and we're not very conscious.
Can you give a quick example for listeners, Dr. Bolter?
Hearing a picture, seeing music.
Okay.
Smelling, if somebody shows you something on TV, like when there's a flower that comes forward, you'd smell the flower. And so that's the senses that are more active, and they're crossed as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when, in the before test, before going into the Great Pyramid, there were very few connections between the chakras, and I was looking for statistical significance. That means that there's less than 1 in 1,000 chance it happened by accident. That the treatment, which was going into the sarcophagus for 2 minutes and then getting measured right away after, and then the post-test, and doing statistical analysis of the data because I had a big enough group, showed that after people integrated and settled a little bit the following day after having the experience, and nobody had been in the Great Pyramid before in this study, the chakras were entrained, and the entire energy field was firing off the heart, which wasn't happening at the beginning. And now we're talking collectively as well.
And this registered on that device?
All of the chakras were entrained at the end.
You could see this with your particular device that you were using?
Yes. And each person's, the size of their energy field was measured before, inside, and after. And there's a logarithm that shows the energetic values of the chakras and whether or not they're aligned. And all of this converts into numbers. And then I was able to do the statistical analysis with this. Now, these machines have been tested over a period of 15 years. Dr. Konstantin Korotkov invented it, and, mm-hmm. and there's like a lot of people, and it's a medical diagnostic device in Russia. I mean, it would be anywhere, but the medical profession accepts it there. And sports psychologists and medical practitioners and all kinds of people that are using this equipment to show how the energy field of a human body is affected by other people, by other places, by what they eat. And so I've been working with the machine for a couple of years now, and it's pretty interesting.
Is this going to be a documentary?
Well, I'm actually running the study again because I'm thinking that even more of a delayed post-test. So I do the post-test the day after and then maybe 3 days after, to see how people integrate. So yes, I'm going to run the study again. We're bringing a crew. We'll be filming. Yes, I'm definitely working on another project.
This is fantastic and great news. I can't wait to see the finished product. A quick question about the energetic alignment within the human body. How long does that last when you're out of the pyramid?
Well, again, we'd have to be measuring a lot, and every single person responds to the energy of the pyramid differently. And so what I've noticed by measuring myself in various situations is that it's almost momentary. And we can lend our energy to other people and then replenish ourselves. And so, I mean, it's quite a deep subject. I'm not sure where you want to go with that, but it changes momentarily. But, I mean, there's patterns as well. But what I'm saying is that people are influenced by one another. They've done experiments. Here's an example,
mm-hmm.
where they'll put the equipment in the room, and then they'll have 30 people walk in the room and sit, and they play a song. They meditate for 10 minutes. They play a song. And then everybody stands up and leaves the room. And they're measuring. It's called an eco-tester.
Mm-hmm.
They're measuring the vibration in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can see that the mark where there's nobody in the room, And then you can see the moment when people walk in, and then the energy goes up when they're playing the song, and it goes up some more when they're meditating. But when everybody leaves, they leave the imprint of the meditative state in the room.
Oh, and how long does that last?
They didn't do a delayed post-test on
that. Oh, okay.
So you go to a restaurant, and you go sit down at a table, and the people who were sitting there before you were arguing. You probably don't want to sit there. Yeah?
I
think we leave energetic imprints. And you know how sometimes people, oh, I love coming to see your house. Your house just feels so good. Well, there's something positive happening there, and the energy is palpable, so people walk in and they feel it.
And now it's measurable.
And that's the point, because I've been interested in this material for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
but we never had devices to measure them. And thanks to the Russians for being so advanced.
I know, and Dr. Kortkoff has been on the show.
Yes.
And he has talked about the GDV. Is that what you're using?
Yes, there's two ways. When you go to explain GDV, it's gaseous discharge visualization.
Mm-hmm.
But they also say EPI, which is electrophotonic imaging. So when you see references to the machine,
mm-hmm.
it's GDV/EPI. And it's complicated for people to understand until they... One analogy would be it's souped-up Corellian photography on steroids. You know, like the difference between going from a 1-megapixel camera to an 18. You know, more data, more information, more sophistication. So essentially what you're doing, it's measuring the photonic emissions coming off the fingertips. And you're putting your fingers on a camera lens.
Mm-hmm.
So a little impulse comes up, and then it can actually capture the photonic emissions. And then it's working on the meridian system, the Chinese meridians, and the nerve endings in the fingers are actually connected to various organs and the overall health. And the other thing that they've added is a filter. So the first measurement without the filter is emotional, spiritual. And the second one with the filter, it's just some little see-through piece of, I don't even know what it's made of,
mm-hmm.
It measures the physical. And it's a comparison between the two where you get these interesting measurements. It's fascinating, and they've really done a good job, and they've done tons of research on it. So, you know, at first you can be a little skeptical, oh, well, what do you mean, and all of that. But the more, it's kind of like astrology. The more you look into it, the more interesting it gets.
Absolutely. I just can't wait to see what you put together here. I mean, it's so exciting, this area. Before we close, I wanted to ask you about your trip to Egypt. Can you tell listeners a little bit about that trip that you're going to take?
Well, it's called Magic Egypt 12-12-12, and it starts on December 8th and goes through till after the galactic alignment on the 22nd. And we'll be inside the Great Pyramid. They've already closed the pyramid for 12-12-12, as they did for 11-11, and so we've got our permits for the 13th. We'll be at the Crystal Altar at Abu Ghraib, which is shown in the Pyramid Code for December 21st at sunset when the exact alignment happens. We're doing a 4-day Nile cruise. We're going to be staying at a resort, which is an island right in the middle of the Nile near Luxor. And we're going to Abydos and Dendera, which are the oldest temples that have incredible frescoes and incredible history. And so it's a full tour of Egypt. Pretty much it's what you see in the Pyramid Code.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what I say in the Pyramid Code, because I wrote it, produced it, and directed it,
mm-hmm.
comes from modeling from this trip that I've led several times.
And you're leading this one?
I'm leading this one. We've got 79 people.
And is that closed? I mean, can people still come aboard on this?
Yeah. We've got the whole boat for the cruise, and so if there's still rooms. And I've just been told that people are self-selecting, and if people want to jump in at the last minute, as long as everything's prepaid before we go, they can.
How do they reach you?
Pyramidcode.com, and then you go trips, and all the information's there, including my email.
Well, Dr. Bolter, producer and director of the Pyramid Code documentary series and author of the book Angels and Archetypes, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.